Good morning. Greetings in the precious name of Jesus. Bring you greetings from the Lenawee congregation in southeast Michigan. It's good to be with you here this morning again. The message I have this morning is born out of a deep need in my own heart, continual struggle and things that I battle with. And as I studied and prepared for this message, I ended up with 14 points. And if we just simply average 5 minutes a point, it's going to put us fairly late. So we have a fair amount of ground to cover. I invite your attention to the book of Exodus to begin with, Exodus 18. And while you're turning there, I would like to explain just a little bit. The title of my message this morning is Criticism, Constructive or Destructive. And yes, I do have 14 points, but no, I do not plan to keep you that late this morning. And it's just, for myself, if I would be sitting in the pews back home and a visitor would come and would say that at the onset of the message, right away my thoughts would start to click and I'd be starting to think, wait a minute, why, who are you to think that you can take the liberty to preach so long and to have 14 points? And maybe I'm alone in thinking that. As I did say, it is an ongoing struggle and need in my own heart. I'd like to look at the scriptures this morning to see what we can learn about this subject. I desire an interest in your prayers as we go through this message. Exodus 18, I'll begin reading in verse 13. It says, "And it came to pass on the morrow that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood by Moses from the morning unto the evening. And when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did to the people, he said, What is this thing that thou doest to the people? Why sittest thou thyself alone, and all the people stand by thee from morning unto even? And Moses said unto his father-in-law, Because the people come unto me to inquire of God. When they have a matter, they come unto me, and I judge between one and another, and I do make them know the statutes of God and his laws. And Moses' father-in-law said unto him, The thing that thou doest is not good. Thou wilt surely wear away both thou and this people that is with thee, for this thing is too heavy for thee. Thou art not able to perform it thyself alone. Hearken now unto my voice. I will give thee counsel, and God shall be with thee. Be thou for the people to Godward, that thou mayest bring the causes unto God, and thou shalt teach them ordinances and laws, and shalt show them the way wherein they must walk, and the work that they must do. Moreover, thou shalt provide out of all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands and rulers of hundreds and rulers of fifties and rulers of tens. And let them judge the people at all seasons, and it shall be that every great matter they shall bring unto thee, but every small matter they shall judge. So shall it be easier for thyself, and they shall bear it, and they shall bear the burden with thee. If thou shalt do this thing, and God command thee so, then thou shalt be able to endure. And all this people shall also go to their place in peace." So Moses hearkened to the voice of his father-in-law, and did all that he had said. And Moses chose able men out of all Israel, and made them heads over the people, rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. And they judged the people at all seasons. The hard causes they brought unto Moses, but every small matter they judged themselves. And Moses let his father-in-law depart, and he went his way into his own land. Now, if you care to, you can turn over to the book of Numbers, in Numbers chapter 12. Numbers chapter 12 and verse 1, it says, "And Miriam and Aaron spake against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married. For he had married an Ethiopian woman, and they said, Hath the Lord indeed spoken only by Moses? Hath he not spoken also by us? And the Lord heard it. Now the man Moses was very meek, above all the men which were upon the face of the earth. And the Lord spake suddenly unto Moses, and unto Aaron, and unto Miriam, Come out, ye three, unto the tabernacle of the congregation. And they three came out. And the Lord came down in the pillar of the cloud, and stood in the door of the tabernacle, and called Aaron and Miriam, and they both came forth. And he said, Hear now my words, if there be a prophet among you, I, the Lord, will make myself known unto him in a vision, and will speak unto him in a dream. My servant Moses is not so, who is faithful in all mine house. With him will I speak mouth to mouth, even apparently, and not in dark speeches, and the similitude of the Lord shall he behold. Wherefore, then, were ye not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? And the anger of the Lord was kindled against them, and he departed. And the cloud departed from off the tabernacle, and behold, Miriam became leprous, white as snow. And Aaron looked upon Miriam, and behold, she was leprous. And Aaron said unto Moses, Alas, my Lord, I beseech thee, lay not the sin upon us, wherein we have done foolishly, and wherein we have sinned. Let her not be as one dead, of whom the flesh is half consumed when he cometh out of his mother's womb. And Moses cried unto the Lord, saying, Heal her now, O God, I beseech thee. And the Lord said unto Moses, If her father had but spit in her face, should she not be ashamed 7 days? Let her be shut out from the camp 7 days. After that, let her be received in again. And Miriam was shut out from the camp 7 days, and the people journeyed not till Miriam was brought in again. And afterward, the people removed from Hazeroth and pitched in the wilderness of Paran. Now, in these two accounts that we read, there was a need, and there was advice or criticism given, but the end result was very, very different. What makes the difference? What makes the difference between Jethro giving criticism to Moses and when Aaron and Miriam criticized Moses? The same man was being criticized, but the result was totally different. I think this whole subject of criticism is common enough to us all that we are all, probably would say, all too familiar with it. Most of us do not enjoy being criticized, and most of us find it easier than we care to admit to criticize others in other situations. So it's a real pertinent issue subject that we deal with. But to my knowledge, the word criticism isn't even in the Bible. But the principle is there. There's a couple other words that have basically the same meaning in the Bible. I'll just give you a couple verses with those words in it. In the Old Testament, in Exodus 16, verse 7, it has the word murmur or murmurings in it. That has a lot of the same concept of meaning as criticism or to criticize. In 1 Timothy in the New Testament, it talks about being a busybody, which is somebody that's overseeing others' affairs or a meddler. Again, has a lot of the same concepts. Back in the Old Testament, we hear the word chide different times. In Exodus it says, Wherefore the people did chide with Moses and said, Give us water that we may drink. And Moses said unto them, Why chide ye with me? Wherefore do you tempt the Lord? That word chide has a lot of the same concept as criticize or criticism. Different times the word complain would have the same meaning, and also discontent, like is used in 1 Samuel 22:2. It says, And everyone that was in distress, and everyone that was in debt, and everyone that was discontented, gathered themselves unto him, which was unto David, and he became a captain over them, and there was with him about 400 men. It must have been quite a group to have those character traits with 400 men, but nevertheless, it has a lot of the same meaning as criticism and being critical. Somebody has said that criticism is something we can avoid easily by saying nothing, doing nothing, and being nothing. And honestly, that's probably the only way to avoid it. But it's not real practical, not really. an option, is it? Someone else has said that constructive criticism is when I criticize you, and destructive criticism is when you criticize me. Something also that I can relate to very well. Now, I'd like to consider the first part of the message. I'd like to consider four seeds of destructive criticism. And if you can picture a seed bed or even larger scale in your fields, when the moisture content is right and the temperature is right and when everything is right, when a seed is dropped in there, it's just bound to flourish. It's bound to grow and take off. I want to look at four seeds of destructive criticism. Number one, if you care to, you can turn to 1 Samuel 18. I don't think I'm going to take the time to read it. But in 1 Samuel 18, there is the account, and this is right following the account of David and Goliath, which happened in 1 Samuel 17. 1 Samuel 18, when Saul and David came back from battle, in verse 6, I'm going to read a couple verses. It says, "It came to pass as they came, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tabrets, with joy, and with instruments of music. And the women answered one another as they played and said, Saul hath slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. And Saul was very wroth, and the saying displeased him. And he said, They have ascribed unto David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed but thousands. And what can he have more but the kingdom? And Saul eyed David from that day forward." The first seed that I want to consider briefly is the pity me attitude, or the pity me seed. Everybody else is better than me. When we have that kind of seed and we drop that into a seed bed of the carnal heart, it's bound to take off and grow and flourish. And we will find it very easy to be guilty of destructive criticism. Back to this account with King Saul in 1 Samuel 18. This is right on the heels of a tremendous victory that David helped them to win. They were at a standoff. Every day they'd go out to meet Goliath, and Goliath would give his challenge, and they would all return to their tents in fear. This is right on the heels of a tremendous victory, and King Saul has the audacity to say, David, he's going to have the kingdom. Because the people are all saying he killed way more people than I did. It was a pity me attitude. The second seed, I simply call it judgment before a trial. And what I mean by that is the person with a critical, destructive critical spirit will often know why so-and-so, I'm just using examples, but they will often know why so-and-so got the new vehicle they did, or why their children acted the way they did, or why they weren't home when we stopped in to visit them, or why it didn't suit them to come visit us when we invited them. And the list goes on and on and on. And we automatically in our minds, we think, we know. We know why they did what they did. And we don't even know the facts. But we have the concept of a judgment before a trial. And that seed, when it's dropped into that seedbed of the carnal heart, will almost always give forth destructive criticism. David's brothers acted this way when David came out to meet his brothers when they were facing Goliath. They asked him, why are you come out here? And then they said, we know why you're out here. You came out here to see the battle. They thought they knew why he was there. Judgment before a trial almost always results in destructive criticism. Number three, when people use concern to mask what is really enviousness or jealousy, that seed, again, almost always results in destructive criticism. We read this account in Exodus 18 about Aaron and Miriam criticizing Moses, and it seems like they used concern to address Moses and to criticize him, but deep in their heart, It was not concern. They just used concern to mask what was really enviousness or jealousy. And number four, the seed of the fear of failure or inadequacy. You remember when God called Moses to go to Pharaoh and to lead his children out of Egypt. And Moses had a whole list. I can't speak, and I can't go. And can you please ask Aaron to go? And on down the list he went. But that concept, that fear of failure and or inadequacy is, again, a perfect seedbed. It's a perfect seed to result in destructive criticism. Now let's move to something a little more positive. Excuse me. Let's look briefly just at four pillars of constructive criticism, or foundations for constructive criticism. Things that typically accompany a kind and concerning spirit, a positive outlook. Number one, they will ask questions from a sincere, caring heart. And I just have three examples here of Jesus in the New Testament. If you remember Jesus and the woman taken in adultery in John 8, Jesus and the woman at the well in John 4, and Jesus and the disciples, especially Philip, in John 14. Jesus, in every situation here, he asked questions. He asked them what he engaged them. He engaged in conversation to, well, Jesus obviously knew everything. But the lesson for us is that we need and should ask questions from a sincere, caring heart so that we can understand at least better where the other person is at, what they're thinking, what makes them do the things they're doing. Positive criticism comes from the kind and concerned spirit, asking questions from a sincere and caring heart. Number two, they treat others the way they want to be treated. In Luke 6:31, the classic verse of the, it says, "And as you would that men should do to you, do ye also to them likewise." Simply put, use the golden rule. That is a foundation, that is a pillar for constructive criticism. Treat others the way you want to be treated. Number three, another pillar of constructive criticism is it's marked by honesty and clarity or frankness. If you care to read the account in John 13, the feet washing story, Jesus commenced to initiate that first feet washing ceremony. And you remember the back and forth that Peter and Jesus had. And Peter said, "You're not washing my feet." And then he said, "Well, then, you know, wash not just my feet, but everything." And Jesus was very patient, and he told him why he's doing it and the purpose of it. And it was marked by honesty and clarity or frankness. If you think about the account in Acts with Aquila and Priscilla, and they took Apollos, I believe it was, off to the side after one of their services, and they explained to him more clearly, more fully, what some of the things were that Apollos was missing. Just simply avoiding the issue, simply never confronting anything, is not the answer. But positive criticism is marked by being honest and clear and frank. And number four, the fourth pillar of constructive criticism, is that it always seeks the other person's best interest. Get on their level. Meet them on their turf. Speak their language, so to speak, if you know what I'm saying. That's in a classic example of this is Jesus, through and through and through in the New Testament. When he met people in need, he got on their need and conversed with them, asked questions, discussed the situation with them, talked to them, when he could have, by all rights, in our opinion, could have very easily just simply criticized them in a negative way. But he didn't. He was always seeking the other person's best interest. Now I'd like to look at practical side of this. I have 6 points that I would like to consider as 6 principles of criticism. If you want to call them principles or takeaways, it may basically mean the same thing. Number one, no man is totally self-reliant. All of us need some help from our fellow man. Romans 14:7 says, "For none of us liveth to himself, and no man dieth to himself." And in 1 Corinthians 4, verse 7, it says, "For who maketh thee to differ from another? And what hast thou that thou didst not receive? Now, if thou didst receive it, why dost thou glory as if thou hadst not received it?" You know, we must listen. We must have the attitude that we don't have life all figured out and all put together in and of ourselves. It seems like sometimes we are so intent on avoiding criticism or avoiding being criticized that we can't even reach our full potential because we're so afraid and we don't want to be criticized, and so we endeavor to just block ourselves off or just avoid situations, avoid people, avoid life, whatever it is. And that's foolhardy. There's no merit and value in that. I think we should somehow, and I don't know how because I'm still learning, but somehow we need to, if we can get past this fear of being criticized and instead realize that we need it and we can learn and we can be helped and we can be improved if we can learn and listen from other people's input in our life. No man is totally self-reliant. And I don't know if this is common with humanity, but I know it's common with me, is to have the mindset that nobody else would need to be helped as much as I would. Nobody else needs criticized like I would. Just simply going to say that's not true. I know it may vary with different people in different areas and different times and such like, but no man is totally self-reliant. Point number two. Our attitude towards the criticism and the giver of it has more to do with how we relate to it than the fact of whether it's true or not. Once there was a little story situation with a man named Dr. Charles Fuller. It says, during a conversation with Dr. Charles Fuller, a man's name came up who had been publicly attacking Dr. Fuller. Fuller said, "Yes, God bless him." Another man said, "You don't seem too upset, Dr. Fuller." And Fuller replied, "Why should I let someone else decide how I'm going to act?" If we can somehow think about other people as being potential allies for us, if we can learn from all these other people's experiences, it can help us tremendously. And we don't need to learn it all on our own. That's easier said than done, I know. But if we can somehow realize that there's something that we likely can learn from other people, it will help us to be a better person. And our attitude towards the actual criticism actually has more to do with it than whether it's actually true or not. Somebody has said, if what they are saying about you is true, mend your ways. If it isn't true, forget it and go on and serve the Lord. Someone else has said, it takes a great person to give sound advice tactfully, but it takes a greater person to accept it graciously. I think there's a lot of truth in that. Number three. Third principle. There are multiple ways of doing something right. You can take an example of a farming operation. One farmer milks his cows twice a day. Another farmer milks them 3 times a day. A carpenter crew, some carpenter crews, everybody cuts their own boards and puts them in place. Some crews have a designated person who does all the cutting, and everybody has their own peculiar job to do. But just because someone else does something differently than you do does not mean that you have to criticize them. And nor does it mean that you have to change everything you are doing to exactly match another method, because there's different ways of doing something right. And sometimes we can tend to get all bothered and wadded up because somebody's criticizing us, or we think somebody's criticizing us for the way we're doing it. And we need to remind ourselves that there's different ways of doing something. And at the end of the day, hopefully all the carpenters get a paycheck and all the farmers get a milk check, and there's different ways of doing it, and it's not really that big of a deal. Number four, by default, we see things through our lenses, and therefore we excuse ourselves and criticize others, and that is to our fault and shame. But that's by default. Let me read you a little quote that illustrates this. When the other fellow is despiteful, he's ugly. But when you act that way, it's just your nerves. When the other fellow is set in his ways, he's obstinate. But when you are, it's just firmness. When the other fellow spends a lot of money, he's extravagant. But when you do, it's just generosity. When the other fellow picks flaws in things, he's cranky. When you do, you're just using good judgment. When the other fellow says what he thinks, he's spiteful or judging. But when you do, you're just being frank. When the other fellow doesn't like your friend, he's prejudiced. But when you don't like his friend, you are simply showing that you are a good judge of human nature. The way you were taught, the things you learned in life, your experiences, your culture, all have a distinct tendency to make you who you are by default. Organized or not so organized. Time conscious or maybe not. We all have our frame of reference, and we all tend to look at life through our lenses, so to speak, from our outlook, and that's all impacted and tends to be affected by what I just said, our culture, the way we were taught, the things we've learned, the things we've gotten hurt by. And so that's by default how we look at life, and it can make some things appear and feel to me as being way out in left field, when my brother down the bench from me doesn't think of it that way at all. It's just by default that we tend to see things through our lenses. And we do well to remember that, because many times the tables can be turned against us just as easily. There's as many or more things that can be criticized in myself as what I tend to criticize in others. I can sit in church and I can hear or see children acting in whatever way, and I can criticize them and say, you know, Johnny's got a problem, or Susie is really. But when my children have issues, they're all legitimate. I mean, they are, because of whatever. We do well to stop and think before we get all up in arms, because the way we view things is directly affected by our experiences and our culture, and it's the same for our brother or our sister down the bench as well. Once there was a young couple that got married and set up housekeeping. And one day, the young man says, "When are you going to start making pie filling like my mother used to make it?" It was silent for just a little bit, and then she said, "And when are you going to start making the dough that my father made?" It's a little play on words, but the truth is there, the fact is there, that there is, most times there's enough equal ways to criticize each other, that it behooves us to think seriously before we get taken up in criticizing our fellow man. Number five, we will be criticized and misunderstood at times in life. That is another principle that we must keep in mind as we think about criticism. To me, it's unfortunate, and I wish it would be different, but again, it seems like the only way to avoid that is to say nothing, do nothing, and be nothing, and that's not a good option. So let's just remember that we will be criticized and misunderstood at times in life. And the more influence you have in life, the more prone you are to this. Back a number of years ago, I don't remember the exact year, but the name Colin Powell was floated as a possible presidential candidate. And somebody was talking to Colin Powell about this, and Colin made this comment, I'm putting it in my own words. He said, why would I want to be president? He said, why would I want to be at the top of the poll, so to speak? He said, when you're at the top and you're in the front, everybody sees all of your mistakes. Doesn't sound quite as typical of political verbiage as we hear today, it seems, but I thought he had a very good way of looking and thinking about that. The more in focus you are, the more influence you have, the more prominent you are, the more you will be criticized. It's just a fact of life. Once there was a father and his son that took a donkey to the market. The man sat on the beast and the boy walked. People along the way said, what a terrible thing. A big, strong fellow sitting on the donkey's back while the youngster has to walk. So the father dismounted and the son took his place. Soon, onlookers remarked, how terrible, this man walking and the little boy sitting. At that, they both got on the donkey's back, only to hear others say, how cruel, two people sitting on one donkey. So off they came, but bystanders commented, how crazy, the donkey has nothing on his back and two people are walking. Finally, they were both carrying the donkey, and they never did make it to the market. There is a balance, because the Bible talks about in the mouth of two or three witnesses, and the Bible also talks about a double-minded man. Being criticized is not a sin. How we relate to it is the acid test. So we will be criticized, but let's remember to relate to it in a right and biblical way. Number six. Sixth principle in relation to criticism is let's believe the best in people. I have been so challenged and sobered by this different times in life. When I've seen a situation, or I saw how somebody acted in a situation, how somebody conducted themselves, or you can fill in the blank. And in my mind, I had this person criticized because I thought that was just such a dumb way to do it. And there were so many better ways to do it. And couldn't they at all get a hold of things and do something better? Only to find out later what some of those people were actually dealing with or going through or struggling with, and then it all made sense. But can we give people some time? When you see a problem in them, can we maybe afford to give them some time for them to see that problem themselves? And again, I'm not ruling out the possibility and sometimes the need for giving some constructive criticism. Because, again, as as we need criticism, so does our fellow man. And there are times that we can tap him on the shoulder and just give a nice gentle nudge and just ask some questions if they understand what's happening or what it looks like to the rest of us. There's a place for that. But many times, if we can give people some time, sometimes some of those problems will take care of themselves. Not always, but sometimes they will. Can we believe that when people criticize us, that they want what is best for us? If we can believe that, and if we can look at criticism through those lenses, it will help us tremendously to be able to accept the truth that is there for us. The best way to help someone is to be in a position where you are able to help them. And this happens when there is a good relationship, and good relationships take time to build. And good relationships need to be built before there is a big need, before there is a need of criticism. You remember the old proverb, before you condemn someone, walk a mile in his moccasins. So if we can build relationships, if we can understand each other and know where each other is at, if we can understand and know why our brother, our fellow man does the things he does, why he responds the way he responds, it is a tremendous help and benefit to help us know how to relate to them. And it helps us to believe the best in them. And it also helps us when they come to us to know that they care about us and they want what is best. When somebody comes and criticizes us, it doesn't mean that we are off the rails and all hope is lost and we're on doomsday course. But it just means that they care about us and they see something that we probably didn't see ourselves and something we can learn and grow from. Someone has said that great is the man who can accept criticism. Greater yet is he who welcomes it. But greatest of all is he who knows how to administer it in a spirit of love and sensitivity without causing pain and chagrin. Let's remember to practice the golden rule when giving criticism. A couple other quotes that I thought resonated with me and applied to this whole subject. When we believe the best in people and there is a need in our opinion, we must relate to it as though they haven't seen or understood everything yet, not that they are being obstinate or rebellious. There's so much good in the worst of us and so much bad in the best of us that it ill behooves the best of us to criticize the rest of us. May God help us to be the kind of people that can humbly accept criticism and learn from it and thereby be a better person. And may God help us when giving criticism to give it sincerely in love, seeking the best in the other person.